For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
This month and next, we're focusing on the Bodhisattva transcendent practices. Tonight, I'm very happy to have Douglas Floyd, our, you know, head of the meditation hall and also our chair of the board, speaking about at least one of those transcendent practices. So, Douglas, thank you very much for speaking.
Well, I have to say that sitting and doing zazen and stewing over having to give a talk, I certainly had subject matter for tonight's talk. And it's helpful that there's so many familiar faces here. I'm going to try to follow my pattern and make this an encouragement talk as much as possible to bring you good news and not just have some sort of dry academic lecture about Dhyana Paramita. Dhyana is very important to us. It's not just one of the paramitas. It's number 8 of the Eightfold Noble Path, and it's part of the name of our school of Buddhism, the Zen school. When Buddhism was moving from India to China, the word dhyana was pronounced as chan in China. And when that moved to Japan, it became Zen. So it's the Zen school, the Dhyana school, and our most noted practice is Zazen, which is seated Dhyana. So what is it? And why do we have to do it? Why can't we just do all the good things that are listed otherwise in the precepts and the Eightfold Noble Path and the other paramitas? Why can't we try to lead ethical lives and be generous and patient and follow, take our vows and study hard to understand the Four Noble Truths and what it means when we talk about shunyata and other technical terms like that? Why isn't that enough to just turn things around for us? It's pretty distinctive what we do. Sitting on the cushion is what distinguishes us from other people who try to lead good lives and figure out what's going on in their lives and in the world and relieve suffering for themselves and others. And the answer to that is we just can't do it. Our mind, as it's been understood by Buddhism sort of implicitly and explicitly through pretty much the entire existence of Buddhism from classical Buddhism onward, is that all of our conscious and intentional activity is driven and shaped and is conditioned by powerful unconscious forces that we cannot even directly observe or affect. The first one, and Tygon has spoken about it before, is the storehouse consciousness, the Alaya Vijana, which is the function of our mind that stores all of the conscious activity that we experience as memories, as things we've learned, conceptual knowledge that we've figured out, and that are retrieved when we come into contact with sensory information. And as we deal with the world, we come into contact with the right circumstances, and out of the Alaya consciousness, the right seeds that have been planted are pulled up to shape and drive our thinking and feeling and sensations and perceptions. The term that seeds is really the technical term, and it's kind of interesting because when we have an experience in our lives, the classical phrase is that a seed is perfumed to the storehouse. Just kind of a mixed metaphor. They want to get it different ways, but it's perfumed. It's like reading a magazine and coming out upon one of those cardboard sheets with the perfume sample on it. If you touch it, that smell will rub off and it will be with you for the rest of the day. And that's exactly what happens with the seeds of experience that go into the Alaya Vijana. Particularly, any kind, when we have any intentional activity, whether that's intentionally thinking about something, making a resolution, making a vow, speaking, or acting, each time we do that, the flavor of that action perfumes a seed that is stored in the Alaya Vijana, and it'll be activated under analogous circumstances, the right circumstances after that. There's a momentum that's created. So if we act or speak out of anger or fear or craving, the seed that's stored as a result of that act or statement or thought is going to be perfumed by the clinging or anger or fear or craving, the desire. So everything we do, this is not just a matter of, we have a sensory impression. We see something and we interpret it based on the Alaya Vijana having a seed spring up and shape our perception. It's not even just that. The Alaya is generating these seeds constantly, even if there are no real stimuli to do it. The Alaya determines what you're even paying attention to. It doesn't respond to sensations. It shapes which sensations your mind is looking for and going to pay attention to. So in classical Buddhism, the idea would have been that you've inherited these seeds. Your mind is full of them as soon as you're born. And we could talk about it as behaviors that are hardwired into us biologically. In classical Buddhism, the idea would have been that you've already had hundreds of thousands or millions of prior lives, and the seeds from those prior lives went into the Alaya Vijana, which was carried forward from life to life to life, because the seeds never go away once they're in the Alaya, until they come out, until they activate behavior. They never go away. So there's a huge momentum shaping what we want to do and how we think and how we're going to behave. And that's complicated even further by an even stronger drive that's called manas. It's the eye consciousness. It's your mind sort of making a mistake. The idea that if you have a visual sensation, your brain here there's a visual stimulus, your eye comes into contact with it, and there's a perception here in your brain. The manas in your mind sort of instinctively says, well, I feel sensations, I have thoughts. There's somebody in there who's observing and having those thoughts and who's thinking. And the manas is churning constantly, creating an I consciousness, an I obsession. And along with the I obsession is the whole misunderstanding that we are some sort of fixed entity and the world is out there and it's other fixed entities. And having that I held so aggressively means that the I is trying to make itself secure. So it's craving whatever will make it feel better and prevent it from being injured. It's the I that's looking, that always is stimulating the conscious mind and our conceptual activity in our awareness in creating status all the time. We're measuring, okay, how do we weigh compared to, you know, how important are we compared to this other person? How low and crummy are we? So all of our activity is shaped by these forces. And those forces even shape our spiritual practice. Because the I is looking for a way to stop the discomfort that we feel, the tension and anxiety. And we try really, really hard to stop it. And that's the manas I, at least partially, trying to do that. So we can, it's good for us to practice patience and a virtuous life and generosity. And in fact, in doing that, we create what in some traditions are called light-colored seeds, which are good things because they help to counteract the craving, painful, angry, obsessive seeds. And they help to open us up and make it possible for us to get some distance from this whole process. It's not hopeless. Even in classical Indian Buddhism, it's not hopeless. Your conscious mind can understand how this is happening, can observe what's happening. And in observing it and in practicing the virtuous acts and following, practicing the paramitas and following the path and following the precepts, create a space that helps us overcome those. But it's hard, and you don't get, just doing it without dhyana doesn't get you very far, because there's a huge amount of inertia and pressure pushing us into this through the deluded life. And that's where dhyana comes in. Dhyana is a technical term, and it's kind of, in a way, it's hard to talk about it because even in classical Indian Buddhism, the word means different things and it has overlaps with other terms. And once it got to China and Japan, it had a very different meaning. But frequently in translations, it's called meditation, which is not real helpful because there are a lot of different things that we use the word kinds of activities and spiritual practices that we use the word meditation for in English. And there are a whole lot of practices in Buddhism that we might call meditation, but they're not dhyana. So, at least in classical Buddhism, dhyana is concentration practices. And it gives rise, I mean, literally a focus on something specific, a narrowed consciousness, sustained attention to one point, one thing. And that could be a mantra. It could be something visualized. A classic one is a colored disc that would be painted onto the ground, and you'd stare at that to lock the mind into it so it doesn't move. And what that does is it interrupts the activity of the manas, and it suppresses the activity of the manas and the craving and quiets down your mind so that you can attain states of mind that are called dhyanas or samadhi, which is a more general term usually. And that prepares you for the practice of prajna, which I'm not talking about. That's going to be somebody else's issue. But the dhyana, it's the practices are kind of interesting because dhyana, there are four dhyanas. The first one, you concentrate and concentrate, and with practice and with success, you drop off craving and ill will, and mana slows down or even stops while that concentration, intense concentration, is going on. And without the craving and ill will and the eye consciousness, there's a lot of relief. Dukkha goes away temporarily, and there's bliss and peace and equanimity. If you keep that up and intend and can practice even more successfully, you get to the second dhyana, and you drop off any idea that not only am I a thing, but there are other things out there. And there's even more bliss and equanimity. The third dhyana, you drop off bliss and equanimity. And in the fourth and final dhyana, there's no awareness of anything. It's total clarity. No feelings. Just equanimity. There's states of concentration beyond that. All sorts of samadhis, especially in the Mahayana Sutras. There's always talk about lots of samadhis. And you can concentration practice can create powers. You can walk on water. You can learn. You can observe your past lives. And so on. By itself, dhyana is, in classical Buddhism, is nothing but preparation for the cultivation of prajna. And you're probably, you're familiar with it. With this, almost certainly from reading any introduction to Buddhism, or if you've practiced in any of the South Asian traditions, they practice Shamatha Vipassana meditation. Shamatha is concentration practices that calm the mind, lead to samadhi so that you can practice Vipassana. Vipassana is insight. You direct the mind, you learn to observe whatever experience you're having in terms of whether it's non-self. And it is impermanent and impure, and it gives rise to dukkha. And having done that over and over again, your mind, you, with the calm mind going over that over and over again, your mind is prepared to make a leap and have a direct perception of impermanence, no self, dukkha, and impurity, and that's prajna. As Mahayana matured and moved to China, things changed a lot. Along with the other Indian schools, China inherited a school, the Tathagata Garba school, which has another number of doctrines that we can talk about. But the most important one is the idea that our mind is inherently, originally awake and not impure. It is fundamentally enlightened. And we just don't recognize that. We're distracted. Thoughts and feelings and craving by the manas and the past of the alaya vijana distract us. We get caught up in the swirl, so we're not aware. of this open, awake quality of our minds and our experience. And that's a very different idea that carries over into what you do on your cushion. Because if that's true, you're not trying to smash down thoughts and feelings and stop having any emotions or thoughts in order to prepare yourself to have prajna arise. It's already there. So what you're just trying to do is figure out a way, how do I stop being distracted? And not just in Zen, but in other Chinese schools, the idea arose that dhyana and prajna in our meditation practice are not separate entities. They're two faces of the same mode of perceiving the world. And rather than talking as, you know, a normal translation of shamatha, I mean, of samadhi and dhyana would be concentration or absorption into something. And in Indian Buddhism, for much of the history of Indian Buddhism, samadhi was read to be a linking of your mind with an object, concentration on something, sustained attention. In later Mahayana and in Chinese tradition, samadhi was read to be a balancing of a calm or settled mind and an awake, attentive mind. So prajna, even in India, is not some sort of knowledge. It's not facts. It's not figuring out concepts. Prajna is the wisdom, the quality of mind that allows you to see through what is illusory. You recognize, I'm having these feelings. I see that. I can see through what's going on. I'm not caught up in it. I'm feeling very much like a self right now, who's at risk of being hurt. Prajna can see through that. That's the case in China as well. But while there are certainly elaborate Chinese philosophical systems that build very, are based on and build upon the elaborate structures of Indian thought, especially Tiantai Buddhism. Even in Tiantai, there's less of that structure, really. Less of the, fewer, I think, of the stages, and more of the focus on you're awakening to this quality of mind, which is a combination of a settled mind and the attentive mind that can see through the illusions and clinging that carry us away, so that when we're sitting on the on our cushion, we're lost and lost and lost, and then we wake up. And in Chinese thought, and from very early, especially for us, probably the most influential text is the Platform Sutra, where there are at least two, maybe three chapters where Huineng is talking, and he makes it clear that that dhyana gives rise to prajna, and prajna gives rise to dhyana at the same time. That a settled mind allows you to see, and because you can see and see through these illusions of self and these clinging thoughts and emotions, you create space and you can settle at the same time. So the Zen school has always had sort of a simplified, less complicated approach to what's going on with dhyana. So dhyana changed from intense concentration to and samadhi at the same time to accept when you needed to refer to them technically, this settled mind that we experience when we sit sometimes. You know, that was carried forward even to a greater extent by Dogen. I mean, we're here, we have to talk about Dogen. Dogen doesn't like for us to talk about dhyana and samadhi and prajna in quite that way as qualities that we're going to cultivate. He doesn't want you to strive to attain states of mind because that's not what it is. We're not striving to attain a specific state of mind, some special realization, some quality to our awareness. What we're trying to do is be aware with whatever experience we have, but step outside of the clinging, absorbed, deluded mind and let it go forward. That any thoughts and feelings that we're having, if we step to the side and let them continue, are just other phenomena. They are our expressions of Buddha and expressions of our awakened mind. They are the Tathagata Garbha as they are. But in order to, I think, to avoid that sort of grasping mind that can affect our spiritual practice, Dogen talks more about awakened activity. Zazen is awakened sitting, and it's just sitting. It's just sitting because we're not in, for a number of reasons, right? It's because we're not trying to get somewhere else. We're not caught up in thinking and feeling and being gone and daydreaming somewhere else while we're sitting. We're just here sitting, and we've stepped outside of that clinging, grasping, neurotic mind that's going to continue, but it will slow down. We will wake up, we'll drift away, we'll come back to it. But zazen, that kind of just sitting, and in which we've delivered ourselves wholly to the act of sitting, is something that carries over to other activities as well. Right? So there could be dishwashing zen, dishwashing dhyana, if you want, or sweeping dhyana, or working at the computer dhyana. The point is to act and be awake, not to act and feel calm, or act and see, oh, this is Buddha. We're stepping outside of that. And by stepping outside of the delusion, we express what is real, and we express the awakened mind. So that's the good news. The good news for us is that we don't have to exercise lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes of practicing dhyana and cultivating samadhis in order to generate more and more and more and more prajna to overcome this illusion that we're a self that we have to protect and sustain. We can experience and realize our awakened mind from the very beginning, anytime, just by sitting and waking up. And from the very first time we sit on the cushion and practice, observe it, feeling our breath, not concentrating on our breath, but feeling our breath and waking up, we have touched on, we have awakened Buddha nature, we are realizing Buddha. When we drift away, we wake up and come back. We've done it. So, it is certainly the case that practicing has other effects. You know, 30 minutes of sitting is 30 minutes of Buddha. 30 years of sitting is 30 years of Buddha. Sitting settles us. It heals us. There is development over time. But from the very beginning, there is a legitimate expression of awakened mind. And the fact that all of you have not only come here, but have continued to come here, suggests that you have felt that realization. So, I will encourage you to keep doing that and keep inspiring yourselves by coming into contact with awakened mind and expressing awakened mind. And expressing awakened mind through the precepts in the paramitas and walking the Eightfold Path. So, thank you.
Thank you, Douglas. Wanted to make a few comments. So Douglas has given us a very pretty comprehensive survey of what's involved classically in the paramita or perfection or transcendent practice of jhana. Sometimes it's referred to as samadhi. It's the fifth of the ten or the sixth. And usually it's translated as meditation. And so all of the ways of looking at the storehouse consciousness and the perfuming of our experience that Douglas has talked about is part of what goes on. The concentrating and settling, especially, which comes up in through insight and is insight, as Douglas was referring to the sixth ancestor Huineng. But what you're talking about brings up a question and problem about why we are studying these paramitas. So I want to say a little bit about that. And as Douglas said, Dogen and the tradition we're in, Dogen says that Zazen is not jhana. Very specifically, Zazen is not learning meditation. So I would say that learning about generosity and studying generosity as a practice, as part of our practice, and ethical conduct and patience and energy or enthusiasm and jhana or meditation, settling, and prajna, insight, and skillful means and vow and powers and wisdom, is the tenth. We're doing that these 2 months not to get something or get somewhere else. And this is kind of subtle, but, and Douglas was speaking of this. So Dogen says, the Zazen we just did before service was not jhana. And yet I would say that all of the things that Douglas was talking about as aspects, classically of what's involved in quote-unquote meditation in Buddhism are available in it. The difference is that we're studying these practices as ways to inform something that goes beyond. Douglas referred to this, we're not trying to master or get... there's a problem in calling these practices perfections, because it's not that we want to get perfect, we want to perfect them or get perfect at them. They're already part of our practice. All of us have some relationship and intricate intimacy with generosity and with vow and with skillful means and with meditation. Zazen is just, as Douglas said, just sitting. And so the main thing I want to say is that we're not doing these practices to as kind of self-help or self-improvement. we don't do Zazen for ourselves. Of course, maybe many of you came here because you wanted to feel a little more settled or a little more peace of mind, and that's fine. But as bodhisattva practices, and these bodhisattva, all of these as bodhisattva practices, we're doing these together with everyone. and we're not doing these, so we'll get to be Buddha sometime in the future. Dogen says we don't. Buddhists don't wait to be Buddhists. So as Douglas was saying, here we are, and the point of studying this and all of all of the aspects classically of meditation that thank you for a very good comprehensive outline of that. And if you have questions, we can go into more of it. Not just today, but for the rest of our practice together. But the point is to just be ourselves, as together with, not caught up in self like Manas, but seeing that we are actually connected. So again, we're not practicing these perfections to become perfect at them, or to become better people even, or to get to be Buddha sometime in the future. These are aspects of how it is that each of us is here tonight. So a little bit of commentary.
And I think that's something that's true, and you may have already spoken about it with the other paramitas, is that in our school, to practice the paramitas is already to experience awakened mind.
Yes.
And I think you asked this maybe last week sometime, is there anyone here who's never given a gift, who's never been generous, and truly generous out of concern for another person? There is awakened mind in that activity. I mean, there are ways in which giving a gift could also be not, right? Where you're giving a gift in order to influence someone or impress them. But a true act of generosity and patience and not acting out of anger or fear or craving are themselves to touch awakened mind, the kind of awakened mind that we experience when we just sit. And it's interesting to me, that's certainly noteworthy of our school of Zen. It's at least there in other schools as well, and it's remarkable how few introductions to Buddhism even nod in the direction of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. So there's just a little bit of time for maybe a couple questions or responses or comments, if anyone else has something. Jeremy.
Yeah, I really appreciate the talk. I think it's cool how you brought the history through to our current point. It really makes you remember how simple. Like, it's like, when I think of Buddhism, or I've thought of Buddhism, it's like this heavenly great thing, this awakened mind is this heavenly great thing, and then we come through to our point now of Dogen's Zazen, and it just makes me realize it's like right here on earth in front of me. And it is fantastic, but it is also right here, very plain and simple and beautiful, and just can't simply say enough about it or anything about it. It's really cool. And I also feel like also the emphasis on not waiting to practice, not waiting to be Buddha, also is really cool, because it also makes me feel like, remember that enlightenment and delusion are not separate at all. So I feel like we're not waiting to get perfectly enlightened, and we're experiencing our delusion at the same time. And this thought of they're just both together, we're just doing them all at the same time. It's really cool. Thank you for your talk.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's interesting that we can say that we wake up in the middle of delusion, but it's also true that we're deluded in the middle of our awakening. Mm-hmm. And I'm impressed that you can take comfort in the fact that this seems, it's so simple and ordinary. I mean, I have to say that sometimes I go, is this it?
Yeah. it's so simple.
You want more. You want more. That you always want more.
And that's why we have more. We have all of these different schools, and we have all these different ways of getting into what is the underpinning of all of this. It's about time to stop, but if there's one more comment or response or question. Yes, Ken.
Your great talk, spoken without notes, so I just move to applause, I would say. Sometimes there's a tendency to think of meditation as a learned skill sort of thing. Can you speak to how it's, you know, that practical paramitas contributes to the meditative practice, and that it's not independent? You have been doing that, but can you say more about that in terms of progressing and other paramitas as being important for meditation?
Well, that's a whole other talk. And
I think I would say that practicing awakening leads to more awakening.
I would add, just to take any of the others and to see how, take one and see how it relates to both the meditation that Douglas was talking about, involved all of the underpinnings of it and the focusing and samadhi and settling and the jhanas, but also our just sitting, which is not exactly meditation. But you can take generosity and see how being generous to yourself and generous to everyone else in the room opens your heart to be just here and also to settle. For example, we can do that with any of the ten. So I encourage all of you, and some of you are formally doing the practice commitment period and studying these 10, but all of us, take any two and really you can see, even sit with, how do they support each other?